everybody by default, and we'll get started. Chag Urim Sameach. It's great to see everyone. And I sent out a link, I think, when I sent out the source sheet. I sent out a link for a new Parsha podcast that my Beit Midrash is doing. I hope you'll take the opportunity to listen to it. Each week it'll be a conversation between two members of the Beit Midrash about the Parsha. So this week, for the first edition, it's Idan Rakovsky and Rabbi Steven Gottlieb talking about, I think, on dreams and dreamers. And it should be interesting. I mean, I listened to it. I found it interesting. So, please try it out. Subscribe to the podcast. Like, follow, whatever it is that you're supposed to do with the podcast. And enjoy. I'm going to continue the practice that we started last week. I found it to be helpful for me, and the feedback that I got from people in the class was that it was helpful for others as well. When I started for the Tuesday and Thursday afternoon classes, where I speak for a unit and then ask for questions and comments and then continue speaking and then ask for questions and comments, as opposed to having the comments along the way. There are downsides to it for me and probably for others, but on balance, I think it's working well. So we are still in Perek Bet, chapter 2 of Melachim, Kings, King Solomon's Ark. Specifically, we talked about last time David instructing Shlomo to be good to Barzillai's children. And then we move into Adoniyahu's stunt, the trick he plays or tries to play in order to get back to the throne. And what we said, it was sentences 13, excuse me, to 25. Okay. Sentences 13 to 25 was, he approaches Bathsheba and he says to her that he would like to have Avishag for himself. He wants to take Avishag as a wife. If you take a look back, we read sentences 13 to 18. So Adoniel came to Bathsheba, mother of Shlomo, and she said to him, Hashalom Balecha, do you come in peace? And he says, Shalom. And he says, Dabar li elayich, I'd like to have a word with you. And she says, Daber, speak. And he says to her, you know that I had the throne. All Israel turned to me to reign. And the monarchy then turned to my brother, because God arranged it to be so. And now I have one question for you, one request really. Do not turn me back. And she said, speak. And he said, we're in sentence 17, please tell Shlomo, and I want you to do it because he's not going to deny your request, and have him give me Avishag HaShunamit, that woman who had been with David, as a wife. And Bathsheba responds, Tov, good, I will speak about you to the king. That was what we saw last time. So, yeah, it was very interesting. The last note I think that we made last time is that he incorrectly assigns the blame for losing the throne to God. Right? Who was it who caused him to lose the throne? It was Bathsheba. Right? It was Bathsheba who caused him to lose the throne. She was the one who spoke to David. But bigger picture, yes, it's because of Hashem. So the first question that I want to address in our conversation is, was Adoniyahu really trying to get to the throne here? Was that his game with Avishag, or had he just fallen in love with this woman who was described to us as a beautiful woman, none like her in all the land, and so on? So the answer, in short, is that it seems to be yes. He's trying to get to the throne. This isn't about his great love for Bathsheba. And the proof of it is the fact that he's not coming to Avishag to discuss anything with her. He's not approaching Avishag's family. He's approaching Bathsheba and Shlomo. And if you take a look at source number one on your sheet, you see Abarbanel say this. He says, Umimi Yisrael hayayodayem shachavi maimlo. He says, who in Israel knew? I should explain the backstory here. Barbanel is noting that some point out, marrying Abishag doesn't make you the next king. Abishag was never with Shlomo in a conjugal way. With David. David never consummated any relationship with her. The text said that explicitly. So he says, who cares? Umimi Yisrael hayodeim shachavim mayimlo. No one else knows that. No one in the general kingdom is aware that there was nothing between David and Abishag on that level. Now, we talked about that in the first chapter, whether everybody's aware or not, but Abarbanel assumes no one knows that. They assume what they assume, and therefore they're going to look at her as the wife of the previous king. When the text says the king did not, quote, know her, that's divine inspiration telling Shmuel that, or telling Yirmiyahu that, I should say, the author of Malachim. Which is why Abishag does not go home. Abishag is still part of the palace. She's in Shlomo's purview. Which is why he didn't go to her or to her family. He went to Shlomo via Batsheva. Abishag bichvod ha-malchus. Now, this is obviously somewhat disturbing to see a human being be considered part of the throne. Like, I read that, you know, with my contemporary eyes, and I'm bothered by that. The only thing I could note is that they didn't take her unwillingly. She knew what she was getting into when she took the job. Having said that, it's very clear, Abarbanel is saying, the fact that Shlomo is the one to ask about whether you can have a relationship with Abishag tells you that she is part of the monarchy, and Adoniyahu knows it. He knows that if he starts a relationship with her, he is making a statement. And that may be why he makes the point in sentence 15 about how he allegedly had the monarchy by rights and by popular acclaim until it went to Shlomo. Malbim says, if you take a look at source number 2, there are various approaches to this line, but I'm using Malbim here. Nasva mimakom haroila el makom acher. He took the crown, he took the throne, Shlomo did, from the place that it was suited to somewhere else. The in Cain al kopanim roi lefayes osi b'meshe yinu li chelek katan. So at least appease me by giving me a little bit of the throne, by letting me marry Abishag. So Adoniyahu is asking for something inappropriate, and he knows it. Malbim goes further in source number 3, and he says bevadai hevin sheyesh lo sakana b'sheila zos. He says Adoniyahu definitely knows that this is a dangerous request. It's a cost-benefit analysis, Malbim says. He wouldn't have taken the risk of asking for Abishag if it was just because he wanted a relationship with her. The reason why he's doing it is because he knows that this is his opportunity to try to get the throne. And so he says it's worth the risk because of the reward that he expects to get. Not really cost benefit, it's risk reward. So he knows full well what he's doing, and it's a calculated risk. Now, I am now going to open this question to the floor. Why does Adoniyahu think he can get away with it? He just got shut down in the previous chapter, right? Why does Adoniyahu think that he's going to get away with this? Yes, Bruria.
I have a different question.
Okay, then I'm going to ask you to wait with that one.
Fine.
Can anyone tell me why Adoniyahu thinks that he's going to get away with this? So I would give you a couple of points. Number one, he thinks that he can take advantage of Batsheva to serve his end. He thinks that he has found a weak link in the chain. If he can persuade Batsheva, Batsheva will persuade Shlomo, which frankly, just says that Adonijah wasn't very bright. But nonetheless, that's one part of it. But I think the bigger part of it is it goes back to what we saw in chapter 1, which is no one has ever said no to Adonijah. It was only the last chapter that was the first time that somebody said to Adonijah, you can't have what you want. Those of you who learned Eov with me will remember the idea that I presented from Carol Newsom, the professor of biblical literature at Emory University, where she talked about narratives, the power of a narrative in which a person looks at the world in a certain way and believes this is the way the world works. And anytime something happens that doesn't fit the narrative, they interpret it away. They say, well, that was an anomaly. That happened because X. But the narrative still holds true. We all have narratives about the world. In Adonijah's view of the world, he gets what he wants. And if you'll say, well, what about chapter 1? Chapter 1 is an anomaly because God didn't want me to have the throne. So God didn't want me to have a throne, that's why I didn't get it. But as a general rule, God is on my side. That's Adonijah's way of looking at the world. And so he thinks, I can get this. This is going to be mine. That's the idea. Okay, Bruria, your question, and then Rebecca, you had a hand up.
I don't understand why you thought marrying Abishag would give him access to the throne.
So this goes back to something that we said last time. I didn't bring it again on the source sheet, but it was a mission in Sanhedrin, if you look at last week's source sheet, which says that no one is allowed to live with the widow of the previous king other than the next king, assuming it's not father and son. So I'm sorry, I should have restated that this time. It was on the source sheet last time. So he thinks that this will grant him title to the throne. It will make him legit.
So Abishag is considered a widow, even though she never married.
So that's the thing. Adonijah, as Abarbanel read it, is banking on the idea that people will view her as a widow, even if she's not. That's the idea.
Okay, thank you. That's
sure. Rebecca, you were going to say something?
Argument that he thought he could, you know, play a Gemma.
Yeah.
Just shows kind of how out of touch she was.
Yes.
You know, in that he hasn't been following the sequence of events to realize the power this woman has, right?
Correct.
It does. So it's kind of hard to,
But what does he know? Meaning, I think that sentence 15 shows he doesn't know how he lost the throne. He doesn't know that Bathsheba was the one who did this, or he would never have said to her, I lost the throne because God took it away from me. No, you lost the throne because I took it away from you. You know.
But it's not even just the throne. I mean, it's the trajectory of the last, since before Shlomo, the power that this woman has had, the position she's had.
Well,
he sort of hasn't been paying attention, which I guess plays to the second part in that he feels a strong sense of entitlement that no one's ever said no to him.
Right, I mean, this leads to a bigger question about Bathsheba's identity, right? Meaning, if I just knew Bathsheba from Shmuel Bet, and I didn't know anything about Malachim, I could assume that she was David's victim, taken into the palace by force, and has no strength of her own. I wouldn't have known that she's a strong person. It's Malachim that's introducing me to Bathsheba in this light. So maybe that's what he believes. Maybe he believes that Bathsheba was this woman David became obsessed with, took for himself, and was his pawn. I don't know. Maybe that's what Adonijah thinks. But, you know, Leah writes in the chat, he was too busy throwing his coronation party. He certainly, you know, you said he was out of touch. I said he wasn't very bright. I'm not sure. But we'll see just how wrong he is shortly. Moish.
I think, you know, you need to be very Shakespearean about this, because it's a very simple story. Adonijah was the king to be. If you're that, there's nothing left for you. If you're not going to be the king, there's nothing left for you. You might as well go down with all your guns blazing.
Got it. So you're saying he's desperate.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my word. Yeah.
Okay, I hear you. And that can be consistent with some of the comments that we read, like from Malbim, about, you know, the risk-reward that's involved here. Okay, so I'm going to go a little further now. We've established that Adoniyahu knows what he's doing. This is fully loaded and he knows it. And he comes to Bathsheba. Look what Bathsheba does though. Bathsheba says, okay. Right? She says, I'm going to do it. Go back to sentence 18. You could, if you wanted to, sort of read into her wording in sentence 18 when she says, good, I'm going to speak to the king about you. You know, you could sort of read that one as I'm going to talk to the king about you. But look what she actually does. Sentence 19. Vatavo Bathsheba el hamelech. Bathsheba went to the king, to Shlomo, Ledaber lo al Adoniyahu, to speak to him about Adoniyahu. By the way, I'm not reading into all the times when it says Melech, Melech Shlomo, Shlomo without Melech. I can't find a consistent pattern. But she goes to Shlomo to speak to him about Adoniyahu. Vayakom haMelech likrasa, king gets up to greet her, which is your first sign that Adoniyahu is in trouble. Vayishtachula, he bows to her. Vayeshev al kisto, he sits on his throne. Vayasim kisei leim hamelech, vateshev limino. And he puts out a throne for the mother of the king, the queen mother, and she sits on his right. And being on the right is a sign of power. This is somebody who is going to tell the king what to do. That's what I would have anticipated. Vatomer, and she says, Sheila achas ketana anochi sho'eles meitach. She says, I have one request of you. Al tashev es panai, don't turn me back. Vayomer la hamelech shalimi. And the king says, like, why would you think I would turn you back? Ask, mother. Ki lo ashev es panayech, I would never turn you back. Vatomer, and she says, Yutanis avishaka shuna misla adoniyahu achicha leisha. Let your brother Adoniyahu marry Avishag. Vayana melech Shlomo vayomer leimo. Shlomo says to his mother, I didn't hear you. V'lama at shoelez Avishag ashunamid la'adoniyahu. Why are you asking for Avishag for Adoniyahu? V'shali lo atam belucha. Why don't you just ask me to make him king? Ki hu achi agadol mimeni. He's my bigger brother, my older brother. V'lo olev yasar kohenu leyoav ben suya. I should ask for the throne for him and for Avyasar and for Yoav. Pause there. Okay, so the question now is, Bathsheba plays it straight. She goes to him and does exactly what Adoniyahu asked her to do. She says, please, I have one request, don't turn me back. Could he marry Avishag? So some commentators, in fact, argue that Bathsheba was duped. She was tricked. Radak reads it that way. Abarbanel reads it that way. Take a look. I brought you a quick quote from Abarbanel in source number 4. V'hine Bathsheba lo hirgisha badavar karaoi. Bathsheba didn't realize what this was about. She didn't understand the seriousness of the matter. And so she went along with it. So says Radak, so says Abarbanel. But I don't buy it. First of all, I don't buy it because remember how sharp she was in the first perek when she framed the issue to David about Adoniyahu's revolt. She had all these different ways in which she changed what Nathan had said to her in order to make this more acceptable and more forceful to David. So that's number one. Number two, if you really want to get a good sense of who Bathsheba is, read Mishlei chapter 31. Mishlei chapter 31 is famous for Eshes Chayo, which starts about at sentence 10 or so. But the first 9 sentences are the king's mother, Bathsheba, giving him advice and talking about what it takes to be a good king. Stay away from wine, stay away from women, practice virtue, help the needy. She gives him good, down-to-earth advice for how to run a kingdom, and it may be argued that the song of Eshes Chayil itself is an extension of her advice to Shlomo. She's telling him what kind of wife he should look for. After saying to him, don't go running after women, she says, here's the woman you should seek, which frankly he never finds. But that'll play out over the course of the year as we see his story. But she's sharp in her actions in chapter 1. She's sharp in her advice to Shlomo in Mishlei 31. And she clearly knows Adonio is a threat. Look how she responded to him. In sentence 13, he came to her, right? And she said to him, Hashalom Bawacha, do you come in peace? She doesn't think that he's an innocent guy. And he says, oh, I'm here in peace. I have a thing I want to say to you. And she says, one word, speak. Right? This is not somebody who trusts Adoniyahu. That's not the way you talk to somebody you trust. And then Adoniyahu says, you know, I had the throne, and everybody turned to me, and then I lost the throne because it was from God for it to go to Shlomo. I just have one request, please don't turn me back. And she says, speak. She knows exactly who he is. She suspects this guy from the start. At the same time, she does seem to be trying to make the pitch. So to me, what Bathsheba is doing here when she says just one small request and Adonio is your brother and all of that, I'll give you two answers first, actually. Malbim gives one answer. Malbim says in source number 5 that Bathsheba is being a politician. He says, Bathsheba chashva ki ze yelatova Shlomo gamkin. She thought this would also benefit Shlomo. Ki baze yashuv elav le'ahava b'sheyimalei cheshek libo. She thought that Adoniyahu would now love Shlomo because Shlomo gave him what he wanted. She thought, appease him, essentially. Satisfy his request, and then he'll play nicely. That's Malbim. But I don't think that's what's going on. I don't think it fits. Rather, to me, I think she knows what she needs to do and what she doesn't need to do. She knows Shlomo is wise. He's wise before chapter 3 when God gives him extra wisdom. David said in the beginning of our chapter that Shlomo is wise. He's already a sharp guy. So she says, he's going to figure it out. I don't need to play my hand in the open. I don't need to make a statement of Adonio is out to get you. You know, be smart. Don't let him marry Abishag. She knows that just by reporting what Adonio asked for, she gets where she needs to go. And Shlomo, for his part, catches on fast. Because in sentence 20, he promised his mother he wouldn't reject her request. But when he hears the request, he immediately rejects it. And then he does something else. He mentions Yoav and Eviatar. Ralbag and Abarbanel have various interesting ideas for why Yoav and Eviatar make it in, but I'm going to focus on Radak, because their ideas are very hard to accept. Radak gives you the answer. Take a look at source number 6, and it's going to play out in the rest of the chapter. Vehevin, he understood, ki av Yasar v'Yoav shavziku es yado ya'atsu huzeh. This is not Adoniyahu's brilliant idea on his own. This is coming from the two others who had supported him, the general Yoav and the former Kohen Gadol Eviasar. Adoniyahu is just acting on their advice. And that explains what's coming next in the chapter. Because the very next story is going to be Shlomo turning to deal with Eviasar. That wasn't part of David's orders. David didn't tell him to do anything with Eviasar, but that's why he does it, because he knows what was driving this. And after that, Yoav is going to hear about what happens with Eviasar, and Yoav is going to panic. Why? Because he knows that Shlomo has figured it out. And so Yoav is going to panic and run to the Mizbeach to try to save himself. We'll talk more about that when we get to Yoav. So Adoniyahu has at this point violated the condition of his survival, right? If you go back to chapter 1, sentence 52, next to last sentence in chapter 1, Shlomo said to him, Im yele ben chayo, if he will be a man of chayo, good character, we'll call it. If he will be someone of good character, not a hair on his head is going to be harmed. But if there's ra'ah in him, if there's bad in him, he's done. And indeed, now he's done. Pasuk Chav Gimel, sentence 23, Vayishavah Melech Shlomo B'Hashem Lemor, he swears by God, saying, Ko yaseh li Elokim v'cho yosif. That's the language of an oath. May God harm me like this if I don't do this. Ki b'nafsho diber Adoniyahu es hadavar hazeh. Adoniyahu has spoken about this at the cost of his life. And he swears again by the God who established him on the throne of David that Adoniyahu will die this day. And he sends Benayahu ben Yehoyada, who we're going to talk a lot about, who strikes him and he dies. That's the end of Adoniyahu. Okay, I'm going to pause. Questions and comments on Bathsheba and the way that she handled this and the death of Adoniyahu. Yeah, Janine.
First of all, I think that I see Bathsheba giving him enough rope to hang himself. She's bringing to the fore what she sees happening, making it more public. And at the same time, maybe she is giving Shlomo a chance to cut his teeth. Like, given,
She's his mother.
Excuse me?
She's his mother. She's helping him to grow, essentially, is what I'm hearing.
Right, yeah, I think so. Because the way she asks it, I find it very strange. When she says, I just have a little question. I mean, that's almost like trying to see, are you going to be wise to what I'm doing? Because she doesn't just say, I have a little question to ask you.
Right.
All of them, she's trying to wheedle them. But I think she's giving him a chance to show his level.
Could be. By the way, I don't know if it's only my computer or others, but your microphone is like buzzing on my computer. Yeah, Debbie says also on hers. I don't know if there's anything you can do. If there's some kind of a control on it. I have no idea. But, okay. Someone sent me a message asking how we know that Yoav and Abiasa were behind the plot. The answer is the text doesn't tell us. But it does tell us that Shlomo thinks so by showing how he named them. He said, why would I give him the throne and Yoav and Abiasar? And then he immediately turns to deal with Abiasar, which was not in the instructions that were left to him. And then Yoav sees it and panics. That's where it is. But there's nowhere explicit in the text that Yoav and Abiasar were behind it.
So he's just assuming.
Yeah. Well, he's not just assuming. Meaning he knows his brother. He knows who was together in this alliance. And he looks like he guessed right. So, you know, I mean, again, Shlomo's wisdom predates chapter 3. That's, I think, clear in the story. Okay, other questions or comments on this phase before we move into Benayahu ben Yehoyada? Okay, then let's go further. So, Benayahu ben Yehoyada is the one who carries it out. There's a lot to say about Benayahu, and it took me a long time to go through all of this and figure it out. It was actually very funny to me, because I spent a lot of time on it, and then I found notes from a class I gave in my first shul about Benayahu ben Yehoyada. I had a series there on little-known figures in Tanakh. So I had done a shiur, this would have been like 1997, 1998, and my notes there had everything I figured out this time. But I completely forgot. That's the way it goes, right? So there is some confusion regarding how many people in Tanakh are named Benayahu ben Yehoyada. And you'll see what I mean when we go through the verses. But there is more than one Benayahu ben Yehoyada in Tanakh, so it appears. I'm going to give you one way to construct it, with the understanding that there are other ways that one could construct it. So, first of all, there is a Benayahu ben Yehoyada who serves David, serves King David. If you look on the sheet in source number 7, I decided I was going to have mercy on you and not have you flip everywhere in Tanakh trying to keep track of Shmuel and Divrei Hayamim and the different, you know, Shmuels for those who have more than one volume. So I tried to bring it all in one place for you. So first of all, from Shmuel Bet, Perek Chet, chapter 8 in Shmuel Bet. This is after David has already taken the throne in Yehuda, after Shaul's son Ishboshet has already been killed. David is on the throne. And the text says, Vayimloch David al kol Yisrael. David reigned over all Israel. Vayhi David osem mishpatut tzedakah lechol amo. He practiced justice, righteousness for his whole nation. Vayoav ben Tsruya hatzava. Yoav at the time is his general. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud Mazkir, this fellow Yehoshaphat is the chronicler. Vitzadok ben Achituv Achimelech ben Ebyasar Kohanim, Usraya Sofer, all of these other positions. Uvnayam ben Yehoyada v'hakresi v'haplesi ubnei David Kohanim hayu. And Benayam ben Yehoyada, and the Kresi uplesi, Kresi uplesi, we don't know what they are at this stage. And the sons of David were, as it says here, Kohanim. So all the commentators say, Kohanim here does not mean priests, descendants of Aharon. That's not what Kohen means here. First of all, you know that from the text itself, because it says the sons of David. Right? David's sons are not Kohanim. So what does it mean? So the answer is, look at the parallel verse that appears in Divrei Hayamim, Chronicles 1. Uvenayahu ben Yehoyada al hakresi v'haplesi, uvnei David harishonim liyad hamelech. Benayahu ben Yehoyada over the kresi uplesi, not and, but over the kresi uplesi, and the sons of David were first at the hand of the king. So Kohen is in its literal sense here. Lichahen is to serve. That's the origin of the term. We use it to mean the descendants of Aharon because they are the ones who serve God in the Mishkan. But Lechahen is actually to serve. So they are all the closest servants of David. Now, from that, I wouldn't know who he is. What does that mean? Serving David. Are they like Nehemiah where they bring out the wine? Like what does serving David mean? So take a look at the next verse that I brought you, which is also from Shmuel Bet. The end of Shmuel Bet, chapter 23, gives us a list of David's great warriors, and for some of them, it tells us about their great deeds. So, if you take a look, the verse there in the Hebrew, it starts, Ubnayahu ben Yehoyada ben Ishchayel. If you're using the English, it's the top of the second side. Ubnayahu ben Yehoyada ben Ishchayel, Rav Pe'alim Mikav Tse'el. Ubnayahu ben Yehoyada was ben Ishchayel. I chose not to translate that for reasons we'll get to, but you could call ben Ishchayel a person of Chayel, a person of good character. Ben doesn't necessarily mean son of. Sometimes it refers to who you are. You are a Ben this. So he's a person of good character. Rav Pe'alim. He performed great deeds. He's from Kabzeel. Hu hika es shnei Ariel Moav. He struck the two Ariel of Moav. So Ariel, I rendered it here as mighty Moabites. The other option, which I think JPS uses, is that it's some kind of temple. Vahu yarad v'hikas ha'ari b'sol chabor b'yom ha'sheleg. He also beat the lion in the pit on a day of snow, on a snowy day, which would have been a day that everybody in the Middle East remembered, obviously. You have a snowy day, and Benayo fought a lion. So those things kind of make the headlines. Vuhu ikas ish mishmar'eh. He also beat the Egyptian of impressive appearance, Uviyad ha-Mitzri chanis, and the Mitzri, this Egyptian, had a spear in his hand. Vayered elav bashavet, and he went against the Egyptian with a staff, Vayigzolas hachanis miyad ha-Mitzri, and he stole the spear away from the Egyptian, vayargeyu bachaniso, and he killed him with his own spear. Another feat of strength. The Gemara actually deduces from this verse, vayigzolas hachanis, that teaches me the difference between geneva and gezela. They both refer to theft, but geneva is to sneak in and take something, gezela to take something by force, like what happened here. Ela asa Benayahu ben Yehoyada. Benayahu ben Yehoyada did these things. Velo shem b'shlosha ha-giborim. He had a name among the three warriors. Min ha-shloshim nichbad. He was more honored than the 30 warriors who are enumerated elsewhere. Vel ha-shlosha loba. He wasn't in the top tier, the top three warriors. You know, fighting a lion, beating a lion takes you out of the 30, but it doesn't put you in the top three. I guess you need to do more. Vayisimeyu David al Mishmato, and David put him in his service. So he is a mighty warrior. This passage, by the way, appears also in Divrei Hayamim Aleph, chapter 11. And one more verse about this Benayahu ben Yehoyada. The last verse I quoted in source number 7. Sar hatzava hashlishi lachodesh hashlishi Benayahu ben Yehoyada hakohen rosh. The general, the third general for the third month in the shifts, was Benayahu ben Yehoyada HaKohen Rosh, the head. The Al Machlukto Asrim Be'arba'a Elef. He had 24,000 in his command. What in the world are you talking about here? So this can't be a military general, because we already know that Yoav is the military general. So Sar HaTzava really shouldn't be translated general. I know why I did it that way on the sheet, but I really shouldn't have done that. That was misleading. But it means the head of the group, the head of the masses. And it means specifically here, he was the lead Kohen among in that shift of Kohanim. In other words, Benayahu ben Yehoyada actually was a Kohen. Even though earlier when it said Kohanim, it was not talking about Kohanim there, he actually is a Kohen in the service in the Mishkan. So what you have here is a Benayahu who serves David, who is a leader, who is a warrior, who is a Kohen leading a shift of Kohanim. Got it? So far so good? Questions or comments on that? We haven't gotten to the confusing part yet. Okay. Second, we have Benayahu ben Yehoyada, who serves Shlomo. And that we've already seen. I gave you the references in source number 8, just so you have them at hand, but we know what this is. This Benayahu ben Yehoyada is the one who was described in chapter 1 as not going along with Adoniyahu. He was the one who David turned to in sentences 32 to 36 when he wanted to anoint Shlomo. He sent Benayahu ben Yehoyada along with Nasan, right? And along with Tzadok HaKohen to anoint Shlomo. But not only that, actually, take a fast look at chapter 1, sentence 36, because this is important in terms of demonstrating the role that Benayahu plays. In sentence 35, David finishes giving instructions to the three of them. And then in sentence 36, look what happens. Vayan Benayahu ben Yehoyada es hamelech vayomer amen. Kein yomar Hashem elokei adoni hamelech. Benayahu answers for the three of them. That tells you something about his stature. If he's answering in front of Tzadok, who is the Kohen Gadol for David, and Nasan, who is the Navi, that tells you that he is somebody of standing in his own right if he's going to answer first. You follow? So this is already at the end of David's life, in the time of Shlomo. And in our chapter, we will see that he is the one who kills Adoniyahu. We already saw that. He is also going to be the one who is sent to kill Yoav, and he's going to have a whole dialogue with Yoav, and he's going to change what Shlomo told him to do. We'll have to get to that. He becomes the general in place of Yoav in our chapter, and he's also going to kill Shimi ben Gera. So he is going to be a lead man for Shlomo. There are all sorts of very interesting midrashim that add to this, what he did for Shlomo. There's a midrash about him getting the milk of a lioness in order to help the king of Persia. We're going to talk a little bit more about his missions probably next week. We're not going to get to it this week. But left to my own devices in reading what we already saw about Benayahu ben Yehoyada working for David in Shmuel Bet and in Divrei Hayamim. And reading what we see here in the beginning of Malachim about him serving Shlomo, I could have assumed it's the same man. Right? There's nothing compelling to say that these are two different people. There could be. He had longevity. And, you know, David's reign lasts for 40 years. So maybe by the end, he wasn't necessarily doing the executions himself. We have other reasons to say he's not doing the executions himself, as I hope to get to. But he's a commander by the time you get to Shlomo. Right? You could have said that. The problem is that there's a third person. And the third person is named Yehoyada ben Benayahu. And he also serves David. Take a look, please, at source number 9 on your sheet, where I just wrote, who? I brought you two verses from Divrei Hayamim. One says, Ve'acharei Achitofel, after Achitofel, not after physically, but after chronologically. Achitofel was David's advisor until Achitofel went over to support Avshalom in his revolt. After Achitofel, the next one up was Yehoyada ben Benayahu. Ve'Evyasar v'Sartzeval HaMelech Yoav. He is around at the same time as Evyasar is the Kohen Gadol, and at the same time that Yoav is serving as general, you have this fellow who is an advisor for David, and his name is Yehoyada, son of Benayahu. Now, could this be somebody entirely different? Sure, but that would be weird. You have a Benayahu ben Yehoyada in the king's service, and you have a Yehoyada ben Benayahu in the king's service. Starting to sound a little fishy. Not only that, there's another Yehoyada who is a Kohen. V'Yehoyada ha-Nagid la'Aharon. Yehoyada was the leader of Aaron, meaning of the Kohanim. V'Imo Shloshes alafim u'shvameos, and he had 3,700 others who were under him. And the commentators there, including Radak, including the commentary listed as Rashi on Divrei Hayamim, say that this is Yehoyada ben Benayahu. This is at the time when David came to Hebron to take the throne. So all of this leads to source number 10. There's a Tosfos in Brachos, there's a Tosfos in Sanhedrin, and piecing them together, what you get is the idea, as seen in this Tosfos here in source number 10, that there were in fact two Benayahu ben Yehoyadas. You had, he goes through some of the verses, I'm not going to take your time going through all of that, you can read it there, and he says, the answer is there are two men named Benayahu ben Yehoyada. There's Benayahu ben Yehoyada who serves David. He has a son, Yehoyada ben Benayahu, who also comes to serve David. And he has a son, Benayahu ben Yehoyada, who was around at the end of David's life, and who becomes the executioner for Shlomo. You follow? That's the idea. I don't know if this is as interesting to you as it is to me. But once I had gone through and sorted out all the psukim, I was not going to leave that on the cutting room floor. So this is something to know. Comments on that before we get to his actual role. Anybody have any notes on that? Okay, let's go further. So clearly, Benayahu Senior was a warrior. That we know. We established that he fights the lion, the whole bit. Benayahu Junior seems to have some kind of military role as well, right? Shlomo is having him execute people. But the Gemara gives Benayahu an entirely different role. A religious leader. And it's each of them. It's both Benayahus who are going to have this. And in order to answer or to show this, you need to know about the Kreti Upleti, who we mentioned. We had said that Benayahu ben Yehoyada was with or was over the Kreti Upleti, or Kresi Upleti, as I feel instinctively I need to say it. There's a well-known halacha sefer called the Kresi Upleti. So that's, it just draws me in that way. But who are they? Well, if you take a look at source number 11, it gives you one picture. This is from Shmuel Bet, chapter 20, part of a military action against Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri led a revolt against David. Vayetzu acharav anshei Yoav, vakresi vaplesi v'chol ha'giborim. They all went after Sheva ben Bichri, Yoav's men, the Kresi and Plesi, and all the warriors. And they went, they left Yerushalayim to go pursue Sheva ben Bichri. So from this, it seems fairly clear that the Kresi and Plesi are warriors. The name is a weird name. So on Divrei HaYamim, there's a commentary which is labeled Rashi, although I think it's understood that it's not actually Rashi. But pseudo-Rashi, if you will, on Divrei HaYamim says, maybe Kresi Uplesi are people from lands with those names. So Kresi could be from Crete. I gave this to you in a list in source number 12. Radak in Shmuel floats the idea, based on the Targum, that these are archers and slingers. Radak also brings you the idea, as Abarbanel does, that these are just two families that are loyal to David that went to fight Sheva ben Bichri. But all of this is problematic. Right? All of this is weird. What's strange about this? Telling me that the Kresi and Plesi are warriors under Benayahu. Yeah, Janine. That's Urim Batumim. Two different things. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, but
isn't the question why we have to, we already have all the people who are the Uyoa.
Yeah.
The warriors. Why did we?
Precisely.
Why do we have to state these people?
Yeah. Now that's the problem here, and Ralbag says it. Take a look at source number 13. Vahumavuar, She'ena Ratzon Bekresi Tzva Giborim. He says the crazy doesn't mean warriors. Kikvar haya Yoav sar tzava l'chol Yisrael. Yoav is in charge of the army. He doesn't have Benayahu running his own private army. So it can't be that these are warriors, says Ralbag. And indeed we have another approach. And this, I think, is what you were thinking of, Janine. And it's very odd to see Ralbag support this idea the way he does. Nonetheless, it's a Gemara that's found in Brachos. It's also found in Sanhedrin. I brought you the Sanhedrin version, which is a little bit more elaborate. Take a look at source number 14. This is talking about how they would go to war. Optional wars, discretionary wars, under David. When David decided that they should go to war, Miyad Yoatzin Ba'Achitofel, they would immediately first take counsel with Achitofel. He's the lead advisor. V'nimlachim b'Sanhedrin, and they would ask of the Sanhedrin. V'sholin b'Urim v'Tumim, and they would inquire of the Urim v'Tumim as well. Am Reb Yosef Mikra. Reb Yosef says, how do you know that that's the order in which they did things in David's court? That that's how they handled things like this? And he gives you a pasuk, except that part of the pasuk isn't actually the pasuk. If you note in the Hebrew and English, I put in a seek there to help you out. This is a pasuk we've actually already seen. If you look back at source number 9, you have the actual text from Divrei HaYamim. Ve'acharei Achisofel Yehoyada ben Benayahu ve'Ebiasar ve'sar tzava la'melech Yoav. So here they call him Benayahu ben Yehoyada instead of Yehoyada ben Benayahu in the Gemara. It's okay. None of the commentators seems terribly disturbed by it. But ve'acharei Achitofel Benayahu ben Yehoyada ve'Ebiasar ve'sar tzava la'melech Yoav. So after Achitofel, was Benayahu ben Yehoyada or Yehoyada ben Benayahu, they held the position at different times, and Abiasar, and the general Yoav. So the Gemara says, from that pasuk, that's the order in which they were consulted. Your order is, Achitofel Zeyoetz, Achitofel was the one they would ask for advice, like the pasuk that says that Achitofel's advice was like the advice of God back in the day. Ubenayahu ben Yehoyada, that's the Sanhedrin. And Ebiasar is the Kohen Gadol, he's the Urim Vetumim. Because that's what the Kohen Gadol wears. And then they quote, the Ubenayahu ben Yehoyada al ha-Kresi v'al ha-Plesi. Ubenayahu ben Yehoyada was over the Kresi u-Plesi, that's the Sanhedrin. The Lama Nikra Shimon Kresi u-Plesi. Why are they called Kresi u-Plesi? What does that mean? Kresi, lichrot, is to cut. Shekortin divrehen. They say their words with precision. They cut their words. Uplesi, from the word pele, shemuflain bima'asehen. Their deeds were wondrous. says the Gemara, Krasi Uplasi is the Sanhedrin. I have to tell you that I am shocked that Ralbag loves this idea. Meaning Ralbag, in our pantheon of commentators, is decidedly on the literalist side. He argues with Medrash all the time. He and Abarbanel often team up, so to speak. I mean, they live centuries apart. Ralbag, you're talking about end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century, and Abarbanel, end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th. But they are the same bent, the same Spanish hard-headed approach, where they'll say, yeah, I know the Medrash says this, but I think it's this. But here, he adopts it wholesale. Take a look at source number 15 as one example of it. He says, it makes sense, because B'nayahu ben Yehoyada is a Kohen. Rotzalomar she'a mufla shebebeis din. He says, B'nayahu was the greatest on the court. Via Rosh le Sanhedrin Gedola, head of the great Sanhedrin. V'u'ayah Kohen, and he was a Kohen. Ka'amur B'nayahu ben Yehoyada a Kohen, like we saw, the Pasuk said so. It's appropriate for the greatest in the Sanhedrin to be a Kohen. Like the Torah says, when you have a dilemma, when you have a halachic problem, go to the Kohen. And the reason why is because Torah will not be lost from the Kohen. The Kohen will always have Torah. He loves this idea. I should note, Radak really does not like this idea. Because Radak says, if you go back to the pasuk that we saw, I'll tell you which one of the pasukim in which we mentioned Krasi Uplasi, I think it was when they went after Sheva ben Bichri.
Number six, I think.
No. When they went after... No, but it doesn't say it. Radak's problem is that at one point he finds a pasuk, which I actually don't think I have on the sheet, which says, Kol ha-krasi v'chol ha-plasi. And that doesn't make sense if it's the Sanhedrin. All of the krasi and all of the plasi. But I actually don't see it here on the sheet right now. So I'd have to go back and find that Radak. But in any case, Radak does not feel as comfortable with this idea. Nonetheless, Sanhedrin, not Sanhedrin, we have a lot of reason to place B'nayahu. Oh, you know what it is? It's Shmuel Bet, chapter 15, sentence 18. That's the pasuk he's referring to, and it's not on my sheet. That's why. Okay. But that's where you'll find it. Okay. We have other reasons to place B'nayahu as a righteous leader. He's clearly not only a warrior. That we know. How do we know that? Take a look at chapter 2, sentences 29 and 30. We haven't gotten to this yet, but it's the next story up with Yoav. After Abiasar, anyway. Look what happens when Yoav flees. Right? Yoav hears what has happened, and he says, now is a good time for me to go run to the Mizbeach. Right? It worked so well for Adoniyahu. So take a look at sentence 29. Vayugad lemelech Shlomo kinas Yoav elo al Hashem. Shlomo was told that Yoav had fled the tent of God. Vihine etzel hamizbeach, and he's next to the altar. Vayishlach Shlomo es Benayahu ben Yehoyada lemor lech pegabo. Shlomo says to Benayahu, hit him, the same way that he told him to do with Adoniyahu. Vayavo Benayahu el ohal Hashem. Benayahu comes to the tent of God. Vayomer elav, and he says to him, Ko Amar HaMelech, so says the king, say, get out of the Mishkan. Vayomer lo, ki fomos, he says, no, I'm going to die here. Vayashev ben Ayawas HaMelech davar leimor, ko diber Yoav v'chawanani, he goes back to Shlomo and he says, this is what Yoav said and this is what I told him. Was he told to get Yoav out of the Mishkan? Shlomo knew where Yoav was. He said, kill him. He didn't tell him, go get him out of the Mishkan. The Gemara is going to pick up on this. We'll see when we learn Yoav's story and say that B'nayahu is not just the weapon of the king. B'nayahu is himself a halachic authority, and he thinks Shlomo's instruction is wrong. He thinks he's not supposed to kill him there in the Mishkan. We'll talk more about that. We have to get to that. But that's that's one piece of evidence that he's not just a warrior. Number two, we talked about the Crazy Uplacy, and I gave you the reference here. It's Divrayamim 1:18-17. But we're not going to go see the text inside because it's already 2:25. But in that pasuk, it says that the Crazy Uplacy are the first at the hands of the king. You can see it back in source number 7. I brought it there. It says that they're the first at the hands of the king. But we already know that Benayahu ben Yehoiada is not in the top rank of warriors. He was above the 30 and below the 3. So he's not the top warrior. Something else is going on here, that he is first at the hand of the king for something that's not military. And not only that, as Ravag noted, he is a Kohen. Kohanim generally are not warriors. Right? We're going to have to talk about how he killed people, because that's an issue. And last, in this point, take a look at source number 17, please. Divrayamim Aleph Tedzayin Hey. This is talking about the musicians when they brought the Aron back to Yerushalayim. And it lists the musicians. I skipped some of them in my English translation. I didn't go through all of them. Asaf is at the head, and then Zechariah, Ye'iel, and so on and so on. And it tells us towards the end of the list, Uvenayahu va'ovid Edom bi'iel b'chlei nevalim. Benayahu is playing stringed instruments. Now, I would have assumed that's just a different Benayahu, but that's not the way the commentators read it. They say this is Benayahu ben Yehoyada. That's the same Benayahu. He's also a musician. So he has different roles, not just a military role, and that supports the read that Crazy Uplacy is Sanhedrin. One last note on that. Source number 18, the Gemara in Brachos. Remember I told you before about how he was called Ben Ish Chayil? So the Ktiv, the words are actually written in Tanakh, Ben Ish Chai. Right? If you've heard of Rabbeinu Yosef Chayim mi Baghdad, a major mystic and halachic authority in Iraq in the 19th century. So he was known as the Ben Ish Chai. That was the name of one of his sfarim. Interestingly, if you were to go back to the first pasuk I brought you about Benayahu ben Yehoyada and the Rav Pa'alim and all that, it's the fourth line in the Hebrew in source number 7. So, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, many of his sfarim for things from that pasuk. So he has a responsa called Rav Pa'alim. He has a commentary, it's quasi-mystical, to the Gemara called the Ben Yehoyada. It's like he used this. But in any case, Ben Ish Chai is what the text says. Says the Gemara in Brachos in source number 18, what does Ben Ish Chai mean? Son of a living man. Atu kulayama b'nei meisei nenu. Is everybody else the sons of dead men? What does that mean? Ela Ben Ish Chai, shafilu b'misaso karui chai. It means he is the living man. Even in death, he is called living. So what you get out of this, or what I hope you get out of this, and I realize it's been confusing jumping around the psukim, like I've had all week to get used to this, but number one, we have multiple people with this identity. This is an inherited position. Number two, though, is that he is more than Shlomo's man to get rid of Adoniyahu, to get rid of Yoav, to get rid of Shimi ben Gera. He is positioned as both a righteous leader and a warrior. And what I want to do, I guess it's 2:29, so I'm going to have to do it next time, is explain why this matters so much. Why do we have such an investment in saying that Benayahu ben Yehoyada is not only a warrior, but is also head of the Sanhedrin? Why does that matter? So that's where we're going to pick up, God willing, next time. But for those who learn Sefer Shoftim with me, you may already know the answer. If you remember, who was the first of the Shoftim? Sorry, Wachana, you're muted. Sorry, what, Alina? Otniel ben Knaz. Do you remember what happened when Kalev wanted to marry off his daughter Achsa? Whoever can conquer the city of Kiryat Sefer can marry her? That's Otniel ben Knaz. So we're going to have to talk about, but the same thing is done to Knaz as we're doing here to Benayahu ben Yehoyada. So God willing, we'll pick up with that next time, and I think it'll give us some interesting insight into that world and into Shlomo. So next time, we finish now Ben Yehoyada. We learn about what happened to Abiasar, and God willing, we'll also start on poor Yoav. I don't know if you could say poor Yoav. We'll start on Yoav at any rate. All right, thank you very much, everybody, and Chag Urim Sameach.
Thank you.